This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Take a sad son and make him better. Thank goodness he's smiling again. A hat-trick off the bench as Spurs score six, yet aren't totally convincing against a sorry Leicester. Brendan Rodgers under some real pressure. Arsenal atop, a disarmingly straightforward win at Brentford. About as simple as Man City's at Wolves. Something-something Erling Haaland and perhaps Jack Grealish isn't on the way out, as some ridiculous podcast suggested last Thursday. Fulham are sixth. Nottingham Forest probably need to stop conceding three at home. Newcastle still only have one win all season. The same number as Everton, who broke their duck on Sunday. Also today, strange reasons for postponement. Moments, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barney Ronay, welcome.
Hi everyone.
Nader Manuaha, hello.
Hello, guys.
And Robin Cowan, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Robbie says, is this the front three panellists fans have been calling for? Will Glenn Denning come off the bench to finally silence the doubters? Very unlikely that he will come off the bench. Let's start at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium then. Ian says, has anyone ever taken being benched for 50 minutes more personally than Son? He didn't really smile until sort of after the game when he was being interviewed, but now he's smiling again. All is well with the world. And Nadim really made a mockery of the idea that he really needed one to go in off his backside, didn't he?
Yeah, you're right. In some ways, maybe like these sort of finishes from outside the box uncontested probably suited him more than, say, running through one-on-one like he had been in recent times. But it was strange to see him on the bench. But then I suppose the difference for me with Spurs this year is the fact that Richarlison was there and he was actually playing quite well in the lead up to this point. So you couldn't even say that it's the wrong sort of decision because people also wanted to see what he would be like. And I thought overall he did well. But then Son comes on. And then Son does that little finish. It's like he gets these shots up just as the ball's slightly off the ground and he whips it in. Be honest, I've tried it. It doesn't go well. But he does that and he's very, very good at it. Did it with the right. Then he's doing it with the left. And then it's like it's 5-2. And I'm thinking, how is Son running through 1v1? And you're a team that's struggling down at the bottom of the league. It was a perfect sort of outcome for him against a side who, you know, for as good as they've been in the past, at this moment in time, you'd probably want them to be defensively stronger. So to see some of those goals and how uncontested they were, like Son needed it, but for Leicester, they need to be doing better and just adding a little bit of pressure because he might not have scored, but it's still Son.
Yeah. I was slightly annoyed, Robin, that his third goal was a bit shit. Like he's done two brilliant ones. The third needed to be like a beautiful diving header for this perfect kind of I'm back moment.
Oh, that would have been a perfect hat trick, wouldn't it? So is it right foot, left foot? Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah. And I really liked your observation, Max, is that he just needs one to be a worldie. that's a different saying. Yeah. And what really interested me was after he scored the first one, you could physically see the relief, couldn't you? And I think we kind of understate that almost as fans who are watching, and that clearly it was weighing quite heavily on him, even though a lot of people were going, oh, it's going to come. But you could see visibly it, because he didn't celebrate really, did he? He just looked totally actually exhausted, like, oh, finally. Mm. And I found that quite interesting.
Oncoming Storm says, was Spurs 6-2 win the worst 6-2 win ever? They played terribly. It's just that Leicester are terrible. Is it possible, Barney, to have an unconvincing 6-2 win? I don't know if I'm miswatching Spurs. I just can't work out if they're good yet.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I mean, Son's goals are obviously amazing. And the skill to be able to shoot like that with both feet is really rare, isn't it? I mean, that's really elite. And it's seems totally natural when he does it. But, people talking about it a lot, but Leicester are terrible and Spurs were winning 3-2. And he is really fast. And he came in against a team that had fallen apart at the back and scored a hat-trick. I don't know if it means Son is back necessarily, just that if you give him loads of space, he's a really good footballer. I agree about Spurs. I don't know if they're any good, really. Spurs fans will know this better. It's one of those things where you really need to watch them in minute detail. But I don't really understand if they have a midfield or not. Like, they have good midfielders, but what is their midfield? What does it do? It's like, it reminds me of when you make a meal and there are good ingredients, you've got really good ingredients, and you've cooked them really properly, but somehow it's not really a meal. There's nothing really at the center of it. What is who's the center of that midfield? What does it do? What are its combinations? Because they are best when I think of them having that five-man defense quite low block, and then I can see the three attacking players zooming into space. I can't really see the midfield, even I know they're all good, quite good ingredients. I don't really know what it is.
Is it a lack of carbs, maybe? You know, you go to a really nice restaurant, but then you need to go to McDonald's later because the portions are too small.
I was thinking maybe, I think if you extend the analogy, like occasionally you get an amazing mouthful that tastes absolutely glorious, and then the rest of it is all a bit stodgy.
There's like pasta and there's also polenta, and I'm for some, you know, there's too many carbs, and none of them really seem to be the main carb. Like, Højbjerg should be a carb, shouldn't he? But he's also often seems to be the most creative person there. And Bentancur, I can see he's a really good midfielder, but he's been sort of misused. It's like he's on the wrong plate, you know. I don't really know. Antonio Conte knows more about football and midfields and things than I do. You know, that might shock some listeners of this pod, and I'm sure he knows what he's doing and he will make that midfield work. But he's not really a midfield coach, is he? That's not necessarily his part that he thinks about obsessively like other coaches. So maybe it will become clear.
I'm with you guys. It's really strange, like, to be at this point in the season, seeing Arsenal top and then seeing Spurs in third unbeaten, same record as Man City. Like, I'm trying to figure out how to describe it, because I do watch Spurs and I think certain elements are good, but then there have been some games where they've looked convincing but still won. So if we said this about City or Liverpool, we say I'll give them credit because they're showing what champions are made of. But because it's Spurs, it's like, oh, well. They'll get, oh, I don't know about this, something doesn't suit my eye. But whilst as every game goes on like this, one thing to look out for is the confidence that Spurs' players will have, and that makes them even tougher to play against, because they'll never believe that they're out, even in a game whereby they're maybe being outrun in their you know, breakfast for dinner midfield or whatever. You know, it's going to be one of those things that they'll always have belief, and with the strike force and stuff that they have and the manager on the sideline demanding that they believe that they will get a result, I can tell you for a fact that stuff goes a long way. So fair play to them. I don't think teams love playing against them per se, but I'd love to see, you know, eventually if they do lose, I'd love to see like the nature of that loss itself and the impact it could have upon them. Because say, yeah, for example, they could have very easily lost to Chelsea a few weeks ago. But then instead you talk about the positive, you know, they fought till the end. They did this, they left, they were cheering. But, you know, if that goal didn't go in, they're leaving and saying, well, I guess we're not as good as Chelsea are. And we look at Chelsea right now, they're not exactly in the best spot, are they?
I reckon the thing is they can win unconvincingly against Wolves and Leicester, but they've also got the ability to win unconvincingly against Man City and Liverpool.
So to mention something about that, I was semi-talking about this yesterday, but I got cut off on the radio. When somebody says, you know, Arsenal are top, but they've only beaten these teams, Arsenal losing to all those teams was the reason why Arteta was under pressure last season. So you win a league, not necessarily because you've beaten Liverpool twice, home and away. It's because of the fact you can accrue those points down at the bottom. I remember one of my managers from a different time was talking about how, you know, is it 48 points you can get from beating the bottom eight twice over? You start thinking about that and those games and that those points you can really get on the board. You're not going to be defined really, unless it's a really key game at the end of the season, by your head-to-heads. And that head-to-head will only matter because they've also been beating those teams as well. So for Arsenal, getting those points on the board, for Spurs, getting those points on the board is key, so that, you know, if you do lose one of those big games, it's not the end of the world because you can still find form on the other side.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it really annoys me. It's kind of a naysayer's point. If you want to object to something, say, well, who have you played? Why haven't you thrashed Real Madrid 7-0 yet? It's like what people say about Gareth Southgate in England, that they, who have they beaten? Who did they beat to get to the semi-finals or the final of a tournament? And the fact is, if you look at who gets to the finals of tournaments, if you actually analyse who wins them, you don't beat Germany 7-0, then Brazil 5-0, then Belgium 10-0. You tend to beat teams who are slightly worse than you and get to the final. That every tournament run is full of teams that might beat you, but you end up beating them, just as winning the league. Man City are very good at beating everyone else, aren't they? And that's how you win a league. It's surprising how many people don't seem to grasp that.
Leicester have let in 22 goals in their opening seven games, Robin, most by any team ever at this stage. Are we just waiting for a Brendan Rodgers announcement, presumably just after this pod finishes? It's an international break. Their next games are Forest, Bournemouth, Palace, Leeds and Wolves. You know, if you're a new manager, you're like, can I have it now, please?
Yeah, there was a spades in the EFL yesterday, and there's a couple more. There might be another one today. Three or four managers have gone, so this seems to be the start of it. Yeah, I just think, I mean, it's, I might ask Nadim, actually, because, like, the same thing keeps happening again and again and again. Last season was all about set pieces and corners. It's becoming everyone flags it up as soon as they concede a corner. I mean, getting rid of him, I'm not sure if that's going to change it, but it does seem like this is on him a little bit, at least.
Yeah. What I would say to that is, as soon as you start doing something in the game which becomes like an obvious weakness, like everybody sees it and it's a talking point for the opposition. So they will always give you a different sort of look to how they might give somebody else, because now people are coming forward almost expecting to score. They're to put an emphasis on, like, we're going to do this. So sometimes they might overload the front because they might think Leicester are weak at the front, or they might overload the back, or they might realise, say, when they look at the Leicester team, it's not the biggest team in the world, and some of the people being asked to do jobs, it's not necessarily, you know, second nature to them to do it. So you think, oh, okay, this is how we're going to do it. This is how I'm going to create the chances. There's no guarantee you'll score. But also, being on the other side where you're a team that's struck to concede quite a few, like, you look around and you think, okay, this is going to be the week where we'll be fine. And then next thing, wallop, you've conceded again. It's all right, just kick out for a throw-in. We can't take any more of these corners. This is getting a bit ridiculous. And it's a tough game. But I think the biggest alarm for me from that Leicester performance, as was the case with other ones, is that, like, they can attack fine. You know, they look familiar in the way that they do it. But it's sort of like the understanding of managing the moments. Because, like I said at the start, no way should Son be running through 1v1 in an open game when you're 5-2 down, with literally 5 minutes to go or whatever it was. So if you don't have enough people that can sort of grasp that and have the right mentality to just say, this is all it is, we're not going to do any more, then it means, you know, you'll be going into some games and teams will always get an opportunity against you because they know that you're going to be open at some point.
Do you think one of the problems Leicester face is they have a new defender, the new Belgian defender, Wout Faes, who has really long, shaggy hair. And like... defenders like that are just destined to be tumbling into the goal. You know, Fabio Colaccini, just every image I have of him is him desperately lunging back, falling over. I see that and I think, no.
Has there ever been a long-haired, sort of buffy-haired defender that killed Klein? Or was that straight hair?
He was like a mountain with like heavy metal hair.
I'm just trying to think.
It's the frizzy hair, isn't it? It's the frizz.
Yeah, the frizz, yeah.
Does it depend if you like David Luiz or not? Because does he not fall into that?
Well, he was at his best, wasn't he, in a three, where he probably was not exposed to falling over his own feet, legging it back. It's just something about that. It looks chaotic. It spreads disorder. It's probably like Nedim was saying, that thing of identifying a weakness. Like, if you say this defender is not very quick, we can get at him. The minute you say that, like, everyone's not really, doesn't like people sprinting at them. The minute you say, oh, that Trent Alexander, yeah, if you run behind him, you'll get... So the minute you focus on that, it becomes a weakness because everyone has that weakness. And maybe the shaggy hair is the same thing. I mean,
well, Todd Bowley said, you know, all-star game North v South, and we went for Tall v Short would be interesting. But actually, if you picked a frizzy-haired Premier League 11 or sort of World 11, I would absolutely love to watch... So you've got David Luiz, Wout Faes and Cucurella. I don't have a right back instantly to mind. And Fellaini is obviously somewhere in the midfield. And I guess René Higuita. Valderrama will play, won't he? So you get those guys in. You'd really love to go and watch that game. Just really entertaining, just sort of hair flying around everywhere. It'll be absolutely glorious.
Just tumbling over each other, all of the clowns.
Melvin says, is it dispiriting to see a team and dominant centre-forward so certain to win the league? Or will teams work out Arsenal and Gabriel Jesus? They keep winning games. As you said, Nathan, keep winning games they didn't win last season. And I think the thing from this game that I thought was, it just seemed so straightforward. It's just not very Arsenal to even win games like that in such a simple way. It was sort of hard to know what to analyse from it because it was just, well, they just turned up and won.
Yeah, I was watching the game and I saw Brentford were applying pressure to Arsenal. They were really trying to press early doors and make them uncomfortable. And Arsenal was still just kind of moving the ball. I was like, okay. So maybe there's a mistake coming. Brentford kept trying to press. Arsenal kept moving the ball. And then before you know it, I think Martinelli had a big chance where he fell over. And that was probably the floor of the first half. And they just showed really good character, composure and belief. Because I think when you start to feel under pressure as a player, especially away from home, it's very easy to just change what you're doing and say, we're just going to go along, or we're just going to go and do something which maybe, you know, we don't want to do, but it's the right thing for that moment. But they were very consistent. And I think for as good as the result was, like, there were elements of that performance which were very, very elite. Because I think others are going to go there and they're not going to have the same sort of joy when the same pressure is applied. And, you know, you think about the fact that, say, like someone like Tony just got an England call up, Frank's being spoken about for this place, there's a good mood in the place, but Arsenal just control the game of football. I didn't think they had that in them. And they says they're controlling it, and now they're top of the league. Obviously, the timing of the goals and stuff helps, but it was very impressive, Max, subtly very impressive, and it puts you again in this weird position where you're like, well, they're still top. So for all the talk about Haaland, this, that, and the other, Arsenal was still top, and they've lost the game, but they're still top.
Can you make it unsubtle for me? How is that happening? What is it?
So there's defensively, I think they're good. They've got good structure, got a good goalkeeper. I think with Partey and Xhaka and stuff in there, they've got good experience and good composure, which seems strange to say about Granit Xhaka, but he's like, overall, he's very composed yesterday. And then they have a front line who are very dangerous. Saka's going to go and take it to you. Martinelli's going to take it to you. And Jesus, even though he's, you know, he's not exactly 6'4", he's pushing people around and offering like a different sort of threat to what people face on a week-to-week basis. So when you see the way that they are playing, they're very, very confident. They believe in the system. They believe in what they're doing, which is why, you know, other teams like Liverpool, City and stuff have been successful in recent years, because everyone gets it. They're all good players and they all get it. They all know it. And they all have the sort of character to really like push it through. And the mistakes, like, you know, every team has mistakes at some point, but for them, they're minimizing them and they're covering up for each other's mistakes. So it's actually like a really cohesive Arsenal team to understand what they're doing. And they've got really key players in key positions. And as a consequence, like, you know, as it stands, I could see they could beat anybody. Obviously, they lost to Man United. They could beat anybody, but the biggest skill, as we said earlier, is the fact that they're beating everybody else as well. Because if they didn't, say that loss to Man United, you think it'd be crippling. Yet still, they are top of the Premier League because they've managed to get 7 or 8 wins against others, which have been very important for them.
Robin, how convinced are you becoming by Arteta and the Arsenal machine?
Well, they haven't beaten anyone yet, have they? No, I am. I think just because of what's happened in the years previous, it's still going to take a long time. It's almost that sort of, you know, when Leicester won the league, that situation where you're still like waiting, even though they're definitely going to win it after like a couple more 3 points. So I think it's going to take a while for those wounds to heal, I feel. But no, it's really impressive. I think that the main thing is that they really have an identity and they stick to it, because even though they lost to Man United and Arteta got really, he got quite a lot of criticism for, you know, that he made that triple substitution. It didn't work, but that's what he wanted to do. And I like the conviction that they have. So it's like, this is what we're going to do. And actually, I think that's a big thing, because there are some teams, I mean, that you're still not absolutely sure what they're trying to do. The only other note I made here was Fabio Vieira's goal was brilliant, but you don't see many goatees in football these days.
Right. So is it the frizzy-haired 11 versus the goatee? Well,
I'm not sure if there's any others. I don't know if that... Did David Brent kill that off, do you think?
Did David James count? I mean, he definitely had one. But you're right, I can't... Did Jesus Navas have one? I mean, I'm really struggling here. I'll give it some thought.
Please do.
And Arsenal play Spurs next week after the international break, the early kickoff on a Saturday, which will be fascinating, won't it? Producer Joel saying Abel Xavier had a goatee. He did, yeah, and a blonde one at that. Mm. Now, 15 years and 181 days old, Ethan Nwaneri came on the pitch, the youngest ever Premier League player. Number one was Walk This Way by the Sugar Babes versus Girls Aloud. He's 6 years younger than Bukayo Saka. Colin Miller, the journalist, tweeting, this is the first ever Football Weekly where the pod is older than a Premier League player. Amos says, how many items of clothing do you have that are older than Arsenal's Ethan Nwaneri? I think I've got a backpacking rucksack from 97. I mean, that's older than many Premier League players. But yeah, I don't know how I'm dealing with aging, but you know.
I'm probably wrong. It's just my opinion. I don't think children should be playing elite sport in any sport.
Okay.
I just don't. You know, who does this benefit? I mean, yeah, it's experience for him, but there's a lot of good football he can be playing. I just think that he would be better off if we weren't talking about him and he wasn't exposed to that entirely adult world at this stage in his life. It's just my opinion in every sport. You know, there was a 15-year-old girl in the women's 100 this year who didn't play. And I thought, I talked to some coaches about this, and there is a strong view that children should not be playing. When you see gymnastics, you know, and all those, a lot of Olympic sports, obviously a lot of those are predicated on the fact that they explicitly coach them towards things that only children can do. And that's completely wrong. And that's nothing to do with football. Football is not that. This kid is obviously very mature and can cope with a man's game. So it's the opposite in many ways. But I don't know. I just personally, I would have a policy of not having children playing.
Where would you put it? What's 17? What's the limit?
I'd say at least, I mean, you know, we have ages where we decide people are mature, don't we? At 16, you're mature enough to do some things. At 17, 18 others, I'd probably say 16. Even though that's entirely arbitrary age, and one 16-year-old is a lot more immature than, obviously they know this guy really well and he's very mature and they've decided he can cope with it. But to me, it always makes me feel a little uncomfortable. Just me.
Nadim, you obviously bring through the system. What would you say?
For me, in regards to people coming through really, really young, like, you can't just have one thing. You can't just be physically good and not technically good, or technically good and not physically good. So the ones who come through, they have both, because you do need to enter that realm where you are playing with other men. And so you need to be able to defend yourself physically, but then also tactically and technically be good enough as well. And as I saw him, I looked at him, I thought, wow, he looks big and old for a 15-year-old. You look, and even the fact that the crazy thing was, maybe he was playing it down, but he didn't even look that excited when he was coming on, didn't look that excited when he was on, didn't look that excited when he was walking off. It's like, that's a very important moment. But obviously the fact that he's younger, he's probably not grasped how important that moment is for the Premier League and for Arsenal. But again, like, it's tough to just put a specific age on it, because some people are ready earlier than others. And my only concern really is that what are you thinking if you're in the Arsenal Academy at any of the age groups above the under 15s and 16s, and you've seen that somebody's come up and just vaulted 100 of you or something like that, and this is the next talent, everybody else, you can go and put yourself in the bin, because everything now begins at under 16. You as an 18-year-old, you're past your best now already.
That's actually a very good point, because on Match of the Day, they said this sends a message to everyone in the academy that if you're good enough, but you're right. If you're an under 17, you've been working, thinking about that moment, you'd be pretty dispirited, actually. Wouldn't you be thinking, well, where does that leave me? They've looked at me and thought, no, yeah. And looked at him. I mean, I'd add also emotionally mature. You have to be, I don't know him. No, they know him well. You know, they see this kid all the time. They know his parents, they know his family, they know him. So obviously they've made a judgment that he's emotionally mature enough to cope with that. I'd just say that, I mean, I know my point doesn't make any sense, because like we say, people mature at different ages, but across the whole of football, is it going to help you? Is it going to be a good thing or a bad? What's it going to give you to play age 15? Is that on the whole going to be destabilizing or encouraging? I don't know what the answer is, but I think we should be cautious. That's all.
I think that's the interesting point, Robin, isn't it? Technically, physically, but mentally, and that's so hard to quantify. And we have no idea if this guy will go on and be an absolute superstar or not, and they may have nothing to do with whether he had a game at 15 or he didn't.
Well, yeah, and that's the point, isn't it? Because now everyone's going to think, well, he got on for Arsenal. I know it was only for like 90 seconds, but if he doesn't make it now, it's almost like, oh, well, he's a failure. And I don't even know what make it is, but you know what I mean? Like, he's putting a lot of pressure on.
We've already written him off.
Yeah, well, that's
kid.
It. Like, he's not, but that's what happens.
I'm saying he's not emotionally mature enough. We're aiming a failure.
Yeah. No, I think Barney's right, though. I think, obviously, they know him well, but when you think about the average 15-year-old and then playing in the Premier League, I mean, I don't know how many would cope with that, you know, properly. But yeah, no, you're right. Nadim, I mean, yeah, he didn't look 15. It wasn't like kind of, you know, Kevin, Harry Enfield. So
That's exactly what I looked like when I was 15. Yeah. I'd have been in DM boots wearing a James t-shirt. I just don't think it would work that well. Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll start at Molyneux. Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu.
it starts the same way.
Can I tell you a secret?
It would start off with a random girl and just say, hey, hun, I'm going to tell you some secret now. Please don't mention it to anybody.
But it quickly escalates.
It just spread like a wildfire.
I still sleep with clubs next to my bed.
I didn't know how far this was going to go.
People seldom show their true selves online. But one man, he's taken it much further.
I was terrified.
Who is the cyberstalker behind these messages?
He actually said to me, good luck proving it's me.
And why is he sending them?
Because he became more and more isolated, he just went within himself even further.
Do you punish someone for acting out whatever is going on in their mind that we don't understand?
And if I could just turn back the clock.
From The Guardian, I'm Shireen Khaleh, and this is Can I Tell You a Secret? A story about obsession, fear, and the lives we lead online. Search for Can I Tell You a Secret wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now. All episodes will be available on Friday, the 23rd of September.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Wolves 0, Manchester City 3. Haaland scored for the seventh consecutive game, 14 in the past nine. Brian says, if Naden was playing against Haaland, how would he approach it? Or is he happy he's retired and doesn't have to? Mark says, you've watched Haaland scoring repeatedly. Any suggestions as to how teams might sensibly defend him and the balance of De Bruyne, Foden, Bernardo, etc.?
Yeah. Well, now that you've mentioned all those other guys, it forms some sort of a matchup nightmare, doesn't it? It's right. Don't worry. Yeah. I'll take Haaland. You go take De Bruyne. You go take Foden. You go take this guy. That's it. It's simple because most of the teams have that depth of talent, don't they? You know, obviously, duh. No, he's very, very good. And when you sort of hear his story about how, like, when he was younger, he was a lot smaller than everybody else playing, interestingly, like older age football. So he had to make sure his movement was spot on because he didn't have the physical advantage. And now here's the growth spurt. Now he's got the physical advantage and all the movement he had before when playing as a smaller player. So it's a very, very tough matchup. And I think as far as defending goes, this is my bailout for all defenders out there. You can never guarantee someone won't score, but you can make it as hard for them as possible. And I think when you play City, you've got to think about the supply because he, you know, he's not going to get the ball from 60 yards out and just run at you and then take on five people and slot it in the top corner. Well, maybe he will one day, but I don't think that's the way it works. But if you try and make them uncomfortable in terms of their play through to him, then at least the finish has to be better or the pass has to be better. So I'd just say, just go out and play and just hope for the best as I sit there with my chocolate digestives in hand, just watching as he wreaks havoc upon teams along with other players. Because it's like you said, there's a matchup nightmare. If Kevin De Bruyne's in the turn, like someone could say, I'm just going to go and man mark him. But then next thing, you've got someone else that's just completely free somewhere else. So they're pretty good when they play well. They're not bad. That might be in a slightly underwhelming. But yeah, I think they'll be okay this year.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned De Bruyne. I sort of wonder if he's sort of having actually an absolute. I mean, he's had so many brilliant spells, but he's having a phenomenal spell. But because of Haaland, Kevin De Bruyne is going under the radar at the moment.
Yeah, kind of. But I think his phenomenal spell is the two things are related. They have two players in there who are able to produce these constant repetitions that are almost unstoppable. De Bruyne's crossing and that kind of final pass from anywhere on the right is so good and so accurate and so quick. And now he's got someone who is always looking for it and moving into the right space. I mean, Haaland is really, I mean, obviously everyone's got this, it's not hard to pick out that he's they're just so good. But I went to the Community Shield game where he had a terrible debut. He wasn't fit. And I said, this is going to take time. And to be fair, I was right. It took one game, you know, but that is still time. That technically counts. I think probably one game in 20 minutes. That's still time. It did take time. And that, I mean, luckily, it turns out Pep Guardiola is a really good coach. You know, he knows. And this is like a kid, someone who makes really complex Lego sets. You've given him pretty straightforward, one of the little Star Wars things, and he just puts it together in 20 seconds and says, there you go, that'll work. To him, this is probably not a difficult task to make I was wondering, we always felt they needed a centre forward. So they've gone and got just this phenomenal centre forward who can has got standing leap that's just mind boggling and yeah, movement, speed, mentality. How many goals would just a regular good centre forward? Yeah. If Mitrovic was in Man City's team, how many would he get? I mean, probably a lot, nowhere near Haaland, because some of those finishes are just, you know, creative and stuff that average humans can't do. But yeah, they've added the bit we felt they needed, but he gives 20% above that because he's incredible. And physically, he can do this incredible stuff. The only other thing I've written down about this game is that Bruno Lage looks like one of the humans in Toy Story. That's actually true, isn't it? That's also true.
Oh, not he doesn't look like Woody. He looks like one of the humans.
Grown up Andy.
Yeah, possibly.
Like it's got that sort of fat. Yeah.
It's an important note to make.
Is that helpful? I don't know if that's helpful.
I think it is helpful. Jack Grealish had a good start to the game, didn't he? And he did well, and he also got sort of kicked in the nether regions, or maybe just above. Actually, it was an incredibly high, ridiculous foul from Nathan Collins. To which, actually, Mike says, I don't know why. I've always enjoyed seeing players complain about refereeing decisions that just can't be complained about. What do you think Nathan Collins was saying when he complained about his red card? No idea. But we did, Robin, write off Jack Grealish on Thursday. So can we write him back on again?
Well, I thought actually, because I loved watching him at Villa. He was like a real maverick and was allowed to pretty much do what he wanted. And I do feel like at City, you're kind of supposed to be the sort of functional part. And up until almost whenever the game was, 2 days ago, he kind of was. And he was doing his job and he was doing it fine. But then against Wolves, he was doing more dribbles. Obviously, the goal got into a good position where he kind of drifted inside. So I do feel like he was kind of unshackled a little bit. And I don't know whether he took it upon himself to do that or if Pep sort of allowed him to. But I do feel like that's been missing a little bit. But that's what I like. You know, he was the most fouled player famously, wasn't he, for Villa? And, you know, that's what we want. More mazy runs, more being clattered, that hair being splayed out. And it's just that's all I want to see more. Yeah, the other thing is I've been binging Cobra Kai.
Right.
I just wonder if Nathan Collins
had been doing the same.
I would have loved if he'd done that, you know, ball after after he'd done
it. No, this question from Alan was good as well. It says, how high would their player's foot need to smash into Jack Grealish's body before home fans wouldn't boo him for the rest of the game? It's slightly unfair to be booed relentlessly for being kicked. Tamish says, should Leicester Wolves just swap managers? One is good going forward, but can't organise a defence. The other is defensively sound, can't buy a goal. They could just build on the other's platforms while fixing their weaknesses. Only an hour's drive between them. Plus, most importantly, both clubs' nicknames are animals, so there'd be no confusion or mixing metaphors in team talks. It's a very good idea. Let's go to the City Ground. Forest 2, Fulham 3. Robin, you were there. How was it?
It was cold, man. I got caught out.
Okay.
The big coat needs to come out of hibernation. But but no, it was good. But yeah, it happened again to Forest. They actually looked really good and more steely and more solid. And then they just completely capitulated again. And I mean, Fulham are a great watch. It was a bit boring the first half, actually. They were just passing it around each other. And it reminded me of that Simpsons episode, you know, with the soccer.
Yes,
and then there's a riot because they were just passing it around each other. But yeah, it was great. But Steve Cooper said afterwards, like, yeah, we've basically got too many new faces and they don't really know each other. And then the international break isn't going to help him with that because they're all going off. So, you know, there's no room for a kind of, I don't know, team building laser quest thing. I don't know what they'd do. But I've got to say, Fulham are a great watch this season. And I know I said it on a previous pod, but Tim Ream is having a great season. And then Marco Silva, because Anthony Robinson was injured, puts him at left back and he has another absolute worldie. I mean, he's taking the piss. It's like, he's like really, really like, look at all these managers who didn't trust him in the Premier League. He is, you know, he's 34. He's just having an absolutely brilliant season.
Yeah, Tim Ream's a good player. I was gonna say, in regards to that Cooper stuff, did he actually come out and say that there are too many new faces? Did he say that?
He said, I think, roughly, he said that he saw bits of the game, it looked like they knew each other, but then there were bits of the game where he felt like they were a new team. That's basically what he said.
Isn't that wild? How could such a thing happen? All these new faces just arrived here completely by accident. That's the...
It's not something you've experienced, is it?
No, not 20. Because, say, with all those players, like, some of them are actively being brought and they're going to sit on the bench and there's nothing you can do about it. Most signings coming in, you're being sold a vision of starting and playing games. But when you see that someone else is already new in your position, it's like, well, what am I doing here? You know what I mean? And it's fine when you're winning. The test is when you're losing and you're surrounded by a bunch of strangers in a new environment, being told everything's going to be all right. It's like, you cynical eyes, like, is it though? Are we going to be okay? Is this the way it's going to be? But I don't know. People still have hope in Forest and there's plenty of time for them to do well. But I think there's a strength within football where you have continuity, and the fact that they have none, as they have the biggest challenge they've faced in 23 years or whatever it is. Like, I think you can see the difference. Fulham have experienced it a few times. And for as much as the fact they're not perfect, they still look a lot more comfortable at this level. Whereas for Forest, they're making mistakes, which are coming from the games where I'd imagine the fan base probably expects 3 points. A game against Fulham at home, you're thinking, well, this is where we get the next three. But as every one of these games goes past, are you going to be getting against a side that's ranked higher in the league? Who knows?
Well, I think we'll get on to the Bournemouth, but it's like, this is the kind of experiment, isn't it? Forest have spent loads of money and got new players. Bournemouth have barely got new players in, but they obviously had a really successful season together last season and they know each other's names and stuff like that. So
yeah,
this is the kind of thing which will be more effective in the end, I'm not sure. But Bournemouth have got more points than Nottingham Forest in the moment.
Plus, of course, Forest still don't have a sponsor, which to me just, it doesn't seem real. I'm not sure if their season is real or is it void in some way. I look at them and I look at them playing and I don't know what product they want me to buy. Yeah. It's confusing.
But it is nice, isn't it, Barney? It looks so nice, so pure.
It started off nice. Right. No, because the shirt's designed with a huge hole in the middle. There is a hole where there should be a spot. Fine, have a big badge, design the shirt differently. There's an absence there. They're playing with an absence. And I look and I think, what do you want me to purchase? I log on to random betting websites just to try and find their name somewhere or make some sense of it. But there is a kind of unpreparedness about that. It does reflect the team. It's like someone running around with their pajamas poking out the bottom of their wedding suit. It's like, you don't look ready. You don't have an illegal Chinese betting website on your chest and you have lots of new players sitting on the bench saying, oh, I was in Sweden about 3 days ago. It's...
I love the idea, Barney, that in the 80s, you were just there watching a JVC TV, painting your walls with Crown paints and drinking Holsten and doing what and buying lots of Wang, whatever it was. Matt says, how many January signings do Forest need to stay up? Yes, it's an excellent question. I guess the point is, Steve Cooper is a really good manager. There's no point in them. If you change that, which I don't think anyone's suggesting they do, the new manager would have all the same problems, right?
So should get rid of him and they should get five new managers. It's inconsistent. Like, why are you sticking with the manager and you're buying 30 new players? Get rid of him. I need four Portuguese guys by next week. And then it will finally make sense.
Quickly, Robin, Palinha scored a beautiful side foot pass from outside the box. How good is he in the flesh?
He's brilliant, yeah, because he's a real destroyer as well. He's under the radar, one of the best signings of the summer, definitely for Fulham, and I imagine probably it'll be at City probably next summer. He's really good, really tenacious. The only thing is, I think he celebrated with the crowd. I believe that was his fifth booking, so he's going to miss the next game.
Ridiculous rule, isn't it? Let's go to St James's Park. Newcastle won, Bournemouth won. Joshua says, Newcastle have only won one game this season. Is Eddie Howe doing a worse job than anyone is talking about? Nadim, they've only lost one as well, which I think was to Liverpool in injury time. It feels like they should be doing better than this, but I guess they had no Callum Wilson, no Sam Maximum. That is not as good a Newcastle when those two are fit.
Yeah, and you would in the same breath, though, we'd also hope that like one or two players being out doesn't mean that the wheels fall off completely. You know, they have lofty ambitions. I don't know if that's true as a fact, but they are an interesting side because I see them and I see the positives that they have. I saw the way they played against City, seen them against Liverpool and stuff, and certain elements are really good. But this is the test now. It's like converting these draws into wins, because the other sides who they're trying to go up against, potentially, they're very good at converting draws into wins. Games where maybe they don't play well, they'll still find a result. So it's going to be It's not a test as such. It's part of the process. But I think the pressure will come because for now, everyone's talking about performance. But then after the international break, if it stays like this, we'll be talking about the points and their position in the league will matter more because it's going to be, well, are they doing well enough? Because now Isak's there, he's scoring. St. James's Park is roaring. You know, everything's great. I didn't want to do another rhyme then. I apologize.
It's okay.
Did that by accident.
Yeah. You could have said boring. Something's boring.
Yeah, no. Well, they're not boring, are they? That's the thing. They're interesting. They're interesting. So, yeah, I think the next series of results after an international break will really kind of set the tone because for all we know, they might be in a great spot or Eddie Howe might be under pressure even though he's got the team playing in a certain manner. The expectations, they're going to only continue to rise. And if it's perceived that he's not going to be helping them get those results, then I'd imagine he'd understand why he'd feel some level of pressure because, you know, the setup is there for them to be more successful.
Barney, 5 points in three games for Gary O'Neill. It's looking very much like they will give him the job and then next game Bournemouth will lose 100-0 and then will for the rest of time.
Yeah, that's a big call.
You're right.
He's sort of got, he has definitely got that kind of nice interim manager, nice guy kind of feel about him, who's on Match of the Day a few times doing an interview and then just disappears. Yeah, I mean that they have Bournemouth. You know, obviously they're trying to sell the club, aren't they? So that will probably decide what happens with the management. And they're going for an American owner, which will, you know, probably, I think, increase the number of American owners. I think, is it nine now? It's getting to eight or nine, which is, it's a sign of something happening.
No, because it's interesting. We've got the pod with Gary Neville that we recorded a couple of weeks ago, and he is very anti-US investment with their model. And do you agree with him?
No, I don't. He's expressed that wrong. What he should be saying, it's not anti-Americanism. It's anti-arrogant, under-informed moronism. Like, anyway, it doesn't matter where you could come from Iceland. If you breeze into an existing culture and assume that the way you want to do things is the correct way and that there's no need to understand what's been happening there for 120 years, if you want to just throw money around almost sort of idiotically, if you want to get rid of experts such as Thomas Tuchel because they don't want to discuss with you, a non-expert, what should happen, then if you want to say those are American qualities and then say if you're anti that, then you must be anti-American, that seems to me in itself anti-American. I don't think it matters what Todd Bowley's accent is or where he's come from. I think he's made some very strange decisions that people are going to question. And there's no doubt that he said the Premier League could learn something from American sport. He introduced the idea of America. Because something is in America, it is good, and you could learn from it. So that came from Todd Bowley, not from Gary Neville. And Gary Neville said, well, we should be slightly wary of that. The fact is, American sport does have checks and balances to that we don't have in English football to compete a competitive product. They know that if one owner becomes too wealthy and powerful, it's going to destroy the integrity of the league. So they have, you know, the draft system counterbalances that. They have salary caps, which is actually quite a good idea. And if that were in any way enforceable, which it totally isn't, that would, I think, be a really good idea to introduce. But it would just fall apart because it's international flow of dark money has hardly been halted by things which are illegal under UK law. So you're not going to be able to manage a salary cap. But no, he shouldn't have said, I'm worried about American people. He should have been worried about hyper-capitalism and ill-informed, throwing your weight around kind of owners rather than America. It's not to do with being American.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, to be fair to him, I think he was talking about American, not all American. You know, it wasn't like an all-American thing. It was, you know,
no, but it came out like that. And people have dismissed his concerns as anti-Americanism. It's not that. It's anti-idiotism.
And that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll begin at Goodison. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Everton 1, West Ham 0. Everton's first win of the season, Robin. Neil Mopai scoring a great goal. Is Lampard turning it around?
I think he is, slowly, isn't he? Sort of on an unbeaten run. It was a really good goal from Neil Mopé. Yeah, no, I think he kind of started to make them look a lot more solid, missing Jordan Pickford as well. And yeah, it's quite a big win. I'm not sure, I don't think they're going to be in a relegation battle, but I don't think they're going to pull up any trees. And I think that's probably what is required for this season for Everton. Well, pretty worried about West Ham, though. They look very flat at the moment.
Yeah. Just a question on Everton to you, Nadim. You were talking about Leicester and their defence and how it just sort of doesn't look like it knows what it's doing. Everton have recruited sort of sensibly there, and that four look really quite good, don't they?
Yeah, they do. They do. But defensively, it's not necessarily solely about the back four. It's about the collective around you as well. So the midfielder are helping out, the forward line are helping out. And I think Lampard understood that was going to be the assignment, because just leaving four to defend, you'll get overloads and bad things will happen. But, you know, fair play to them. I think since in signing Connor Cody, I think that's a really good signing. He's somebody who, you know, seems desperate to defend well and to do it with his teammates and make them understand how important it is to be in the right position, to be making the right decisions. And those sorts of leaders, bringing them in, like, you know, as an England international, that is a really, really good signing. And as a consequence, they've not won a ton of games. And at times they've not looked that good, but they've always been in and around the game because they're not conceding too many. I'm not sure exactly. I think, yeah, they've conceded, I think it's 6 goals in 7 games. That's very good. You know, and when we think about Everton last year, when they were falling off the planet with some of the results and so on, they looked like a side which people would almost enjoy playing against, whereas that has now gone, it feels like, and at least for now anyway. So I think fair play to them from building from the back, because the glamorous thing to do to try and get fans on side most of the time is just build from the front, do something really sexy and exciting, bring this in, say we're going to be getting 55 crosses in a game from a person wearing white boots who's going to take an underlap from this inverted fullback who comes inside and all this. But
hey, James Tarkowski could do that. You don't know that.
Yeah, it might not look as good as, say, someone else doing it, but he definitely could. That's a fact.
Barney, West Ham have scored 3 goals in 7 matches. Again, doesn't sound amazingly interesting. David Moyes was a bit touchy afterwards. Someone called him Moisey and he was disappointed with being referred to as Moisey. It was a little bit familiar. How worried should West Ham be? How worried should David Moyes be? How worried should we all be about their predicament?
Well, David Moyes should definitely be worried. David Moyes is the best David Moyes. David Moyes just looking furious and looking around himself, eyes wide. That's the David Moyes I like. And I think that's the David Moyes that is most successful. I don't know, is David Moyes a victim of his own success? That's a thing people say in football, isn't it? I mean, are they as good as they seem to be? They had a really good season, but in many ways that was
a mistake.
Some of the players played really well, and they kind of, I guess they've recruited up front now, but that doesn't seem to have actually improved them. that was always the thing. They lack depth up front, but now they do have that, and they seem to have got much worse. They'll be fine. They'll get relegated. I think that there's a danger they might sack David Moyes, and then that, who knows what would happen. I don't think the players in the squad are necessarily so good that they should be 6th, 5th in the league. They'll be okay. They'll get it together, start winning a few games. David Moyes will look worried. He'll be fine.
Villa 1, Southampton 0. Jeff Stelling tweeted, Villa Southampton must be up there with the worst ever Premier League games. A terrible advert for the Premier League, Robin.
Yeah, I believe that's why Barry isn't here, is it? He's at the library continuing his research as to whether Ralph Hasenhüttl is any good. True. So he's keep going with that. The research continues.
That's a fair point. Don't Southampton seem to lose? They lose every game.
10.
But are somehow not 10. Bottom of the league. I don't know how that works.
Southampton are so weird, man. They beat Chelsea and then they immediately lose to Wolves, who are really not very good. It's just they, as I say, they really need a PhD on Southampton.
Mm-hmm. This is a two-parter. First thing, like, Southampton now, all of a sudden, because of the recruitment, feel like an under-23s team. There's certain elements where they do just feel really youthful, and the players have got a lot of potential. But it's weird seeing them sort of just competing at this Premier League level, because when it clicks, it's great. But when it's not clicking, it's like, I don't currently have the belief they'll get out of any situation, which is a negative one that's happening within a game. But then to give credit, like, I think that signing Bela Kochap, I think he's going to be really good, you know. I think he's going to be really good. One of my friends, I think he brought him over and he said he's supposed to be the next big thing. And I was like, yeah, okay, good luck with that. But I kind of get it. And the other side of it, I was guilty of being involved in one of the worst games in Premier League history.
Oh, right.
And it was... Yeah, it's 2015, and it was a game, I think it's 2015, a game between QPR, or maybe it was 13, game between QPR and Reading.
Yeah, sounds bad. Sounds bad already.
And it was at Reading. I think it was on a Sunday. It was on TV.
Early
and
kickoff.
It was a case of
must be yes, early kickoff.
And it was,
yeah.
If you won, we were both about to go down, but if you won, you stayed up for another week and it finished 0-0. So you make of that whatever you want. And we both went down that day.
Oh no.
So, yeah, that's what happened.
Was it quite nice for the other team to also get relegated on the same day? Like did it kind of ease the pain a little bit?
Could you hold each other?
Yeah. No, it was just one of those where, you know, even if the team had won, you'd go into the next week and you probably would have gone down because we were just all so bad. Like when the wheels fall off in the Premier League and you're just horrible, horrible team. You're like, we've still got the chance, we'll be okay. But the fans are turning up knowing it's going to be awful. And the players are turning up knowing, like, this is going to be, like, the scrappiest thing ever. And just hope for the best. But it's ultimately not going to be the great show and performance. This is the Premier League. This Reading versus QPR.
Yeah, if there's another pandemic and we have to go back to doing watch-alongs, we'll do that as the first one. We'll do Reading 0, QPR 0. We'll get you and a couple of other players and just watch it back for the agony.
It's horrible.
Let's talk about Brighton's new manager. They've brought in former Shakhtar and Sassuolo boss Roberto Di Zerbi as a manager. Beyond having a goatee, Barney, do you know any more?
Well, he's kind of, he's in his backstory and he's kind of Graham Potter with a sculpted beard, really. I mean, he's been on a similar kind of journey. He's a intelligent, sort of data-friendly kind of coach. I think from what I've read, I don't know, I can't claim to have watched his teams a lot in the flesh. He seems maybe a little bit more attacking in style than early Graham Potter was. But they've been looking at coaches for a long time, you know, while Graham Potter was still there, and they've decided this guy. They described him as a cultural fit, which is kind of good. I mean, I guess if you want to just carry on the culture you've got, that makes sense. They didn't sack their manager. There was nothing wrong. The team functioning really well. So if you want, a slightly more exciting looking Graham Potter with good facial hair, then they've done the research and that's what they've got.
Much more fun if a chairman came out and said, culturally, this guy does not fit. but do you know what? We thought, sod it, we'll give it a try. Matt makes quite a good point. At the start of 2022, who would have thought Vladimir Putin would have the biggest impact on Brighton and Hove Albion? No war equals no sanctions equals no new Chelsea owner. Unlikely Chelsea would steal Potter. De Zerbi would still be managing Shakhtar. And actually, Barney, you wrote a piece connecting all the dots of Russia, Qatar, the World Cup. A lot of people asked if you could just, I mean, it's sort of, it was a very good piece, but it was quite depressing at the same time, Barney. I don't know if that was we've all been having these conversations for quite a long time about joining these dots and realizing that this is all quite bleak. But I don't know if you've concluded what your conclusion is. Do we just keep watching and with that knowledge? What do we do?
Well, the thing is that it's insoluble because this is geopolitics. You know, what can you do? There's nothing you can do. You can't say I'm going to stop watching football, because then you're giving up that thing that you love and which is valuable and which essentially belongs to the people, and saying you can have it now. But it is fascinating. It's obviously a massive topic, but looking back, I was in the room when Qatar were announced as World Cup hosts, and the general, even from experienced sort of journalists who've been following this intensely, the general vibe was total bafflement. It really was bafflement. It was like, this is really strange. Why has this happened? Is this an oversight? Is this pure corruption? You know, what's happening? How do you explain this? And then, of course, 12 years on, makes total sense. Qatar knew. This is where football is the show that accompanies what's happening in the rest of our world. And we now have blocks of carbon producers and non-carbon producers. And that's the way it is. And football is a kind of strand in that. And as the kind of, the circus to go with the bread, it's very obvious. And it's worked out brilliantly for Qatar. It really has. They utterly called it. I'm convinced that the World Cup was about security for Qatar. It was about not wanting to be in there, in words I've heard, another Kuwait. It was about appearing on the map. It was about, we have these incredible resources, but could you pick us out off the map? Nobody's invading Qatar now. Qatar is a player on the world stage. People know it has allies. Great Britain has a joint typhoon squadron with Qatar, the only country it has a joint military squadron with, Air Force squadron with. Did you know that? I didn't know that.
I didn't know that.
So it's an ally. We look to them as our, you know, as the war has really sharpened that process. And you can now see very clearly the joins of producers and non-producers of this stuff. And that's the world order. And football is sort of right there in the front seat. You know, dancing around, being the kind of court jester at this thing. It's kind of fascinating. And think about that while you watch the World Cup from under a blanket, shivering slightly. You've paid for it.
If only the Emir had watched QPR Reading as their first game, and then perhaps it would all be different. Anyway, look, we're going to do loads of specials on Qatar as we build up to the World Cup. WSL started this weekend. Please listen to the Guardian Women's Football Weekly. Two big results, big surprises. Man City going down 4-3 at Villa, Robin. Rachel Daly getting a couple. And Chelsea losing to Liverpool in a game of three penalties.
Three penalties, yeah. I think all of them were penalties. But yeah, no, Chelsea, that was a big shock. Liverpool just newly promoted. Chelsea were just real lack of intensity. Little bit of fortune on Liverpool's side, a couple of very tight offsides. It looks like Sam Kerr was onside for one of her goals. But we were slightly concerned, you know, after it was cancelled last weekend, that it would be a bit of a damp squib. But actually, it looks like quite a few of them had record crowds in their stadiums. And yeah, it, fantastic to see that, you know, we had some shock results. So yeah, no, really good start to the WSL.
Ben Foster, he's retired. I imagine you must have played with Ben Foster, Nadim, mustn't you? I mean, I
played with. No. How old is he?
I mean, it's hard to tell, isn't it? He must be 40 odd.
Yeah, I was going to say, I played against him a few times, but like when he was like at Watford and stuff. So he's fair play to him. You know, I think it's very clear what he's going to be doing now that he's retired from football, because he's done it very well whilst he was playing football. So more power to him. And yeah, let's see how that goes.
Yeah, we don't really like ex-pros on the pod, but he might be good, Ben, mightn't he? He's a lovely chap.
Once enough.
A shout out to Hull, who conceded the most magnificent cock-up of a goal against Swansea, culminating the keeper tripping his own defender. Not a lot of contact, but he had the right to go down. Middlesbrough fans held up a banner in support of Chris Kamara as well, who was worried about being a fraud when he left Sky, you know, after getting a praxia and not being able to deliver all the words. But it was very supportive, and he's a good man. It was a nice touch. Mark says, during the week where various fixtures were postponed owing to the death of the monarch, is this the most tenuous reason for rescheduling a match? Chesham 2, Bracknell 2. The match was switched to Friday as Taskmaster was being filmed at the ground on Saturday. And Bracknell seemed more comfortable with the switch as they dominated the opening half. So I believe Alex Horn is a Chesham fan, isn't he? So maybe he had a say in that. Speaking of Chesham, Robin, you enjoyed the Tano man singing, deciding to sing the national anthem himself because they didn't have a version with God Save the King. So he went and did it himself.
Yeah, and he kind of went, God save our gracious king. It's magnificent. More of that, please. More of that. I remember I did a FA Cup game last year, and Dion Dublin was there, and we were finding out whether they were going to. There was a live sort of you know, bugle, or on the tape, and he said, "I'll do it," which I would have loved on his tube, but unfortunately, that didn't happen.
Anyway, that'll pretty much do for today. A very self-indulgent thank you from me to Daniel, and more specifically, his wife, Larissa, who crocheted young Ian Rushton a moose in Cambridge United colours and then sent it to my work in Sydney. We have the moose, and Ian likes it, so that's very kind of you. Thank you, Nadim. Thanks for your time.
Absolute pleasure, like always.
Thank you, Barney.
Cheers, everyone.
Thank you, Robin.
Thanks, Max.
We'll be back tomorrow with a Europod. Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.